Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello, I'm Marcia Langton, and I pay tribute to the Wurundjeri traditional owners and their elders, past and present. I live and work on their country and enjoy the fruits of their long and hard struggle for First Nations rights and dignity and for recognition and a treaty. Tonight, I am honoured to speak to three great writers from other First Nations, and I will be talking to them primarily about their award-winning novels. Melissa Lukashenko, a Guri author of Bundjalung Heritage. Melissa was the winner of the Miles Franklin Award for Too Much Lip. Nadi Simpson, a Yuwalari musician, educator and debut novelist, winner of the Black and Right Writing Fellowship for Song of the Crocodile, and Karen Wilde of Maru descent, winner of the 2020 Dorothy Hewitt Award for an unpublished manuscript for Where the Fruit Falls. So welcome, a big welcome to Melissa and Karen and also Amber and Celeste, who are hand signing for us. So I thought we'd start with readings because it's such a wonderful way to be introduced to a work. So we'll start with you, Melissa, reading from Too Much Lip.
Okay. Bugulbe Nanang, thank you. Jingawala Jimbalung, hello, friends. I'm speaking to you tonight from the lands of the Yuggera people, and I pay my respects to Yuggera traditional owners, to all Indigenous elders, past and present, and indeed to all elders from all backgrounds who may be listening tonight. This is my book, Too Much Lip, which I wrote on Yuggera land. And I'll just read you half a page or so from chapter 14, where one of the major characters, Ken, is announcing his political agenda to his family and followers at a family barbecue. "Us mob need to start a revolution, dead set," Ken announced to the party as he basted the lamb sizzling in front of him. A mighty cheer erupted from everyone, even the strays from the pub. Encouraged, he went on. "A blackfella revolution from Dorongo to Darwin." Ken wiped his forehead, happy about his decision to go with Cousy Chris's homemade spit rather than dig a cup Murray. "Ah, nothing like it. A gathering of the mob, a charge, and a bloody good feed in the great outdoors. Oppressed peoples must be the agents of their own liberation," agreed Zippo, owner of the cigarette lighter at the protest. "But real revolution takes in the economic struggle too, brother." A weathered matey grandfather, Zippo had taken to Ken's haphazard political theories with intense interest. The two men had argued like cats and dogs for a week, then bonded over a shared hatred of the prison industrial complex. Between them, they were in imminent danger of developing a recipe for a new Australian democracy. "Sovereignty's got to be the priority, hairy man," Ken counselled. "Treaty first for the Guri men, man, then we can talk socialism." "Oi, Guri woman too," Savannah joked on her way upstairs, for Uncle Neil had last night revealed a great-grandfather born on the third mission south of Rivertown. It was startling information that nobody except Pretty Mary was quite sure what to do with. "You're not black," Cousin Chris had informed Savannah furiously. "It takes more than just finding an ancestor, girlfriend." "Nah, one drop rule," Pretty Mary disagreed. "If their family was here before Captain Cook rocked up, then they blackfellas, and that's an end of it." Ken had scratched his head at the discovery. He'd erupted too loudly and too often about Johnny-come-latelys to agree aloud with Pretty Mary. And now when he looked at Savannah, his affection was diluted with chagrin. She and he wore matching red T-shirts that read, "Protect our sovereign waters." Ken, like every other Salter, knew with crystal clarity, had always known that the waters around Ava's Island belonged to their Bundjalung mob. Just exactly who constituted that mob, though, and who now fell outside of it, was a little less clear than it ought to be.
Thank you. Nadi.
I'm up. Oh, I should just say I'm in Earlwood in Sydney, Bidigal and Mongol country, and sending respects to our elders, my senior knowledge holders that I'm here with in this Zoom and throughout the countries that we're connected to today. I'm going to read a little bit about a character called Jackie Bird, who's a song man. And when I was trying to write this story, and I thought, I don't know how to write, I know how to sing. This character, Jackie Bird, song man, helped me get through it. So this is when he first comes into the story. Jackie Bird began existence as a piece of his mother's hair. She pulled from her head a strand, glossy and long and soft with curl, and kissed it before releasing it to float within the universe. It couldn't be said what the strand would become, herself a bird that was also a star, who also at times was a woman. The hair tumbled past campfires that dotted the night sky, each half hosting two or three, or possibly 12 giants, all of whom tended muscles in the fires before them. "There goes Baralga's son," they would say, as they prodded and turned the sizzling, spitting shellfish among the coals. "Still a strand of hair. I wonder what he'll become." The giants sat beside fires and cooked for their smaller earthbound kin, who, upon their death and their journey through smoke and dirt, would find a great feast awaiting them. The stars in the sky were in fact hearths, each of them comprising a family waiting for their loved ones to arrive. The large men and women sat cross-legged next to each other, each with a length of twined rope tied loosely around their left big toe. The binding trailed away into the blackness, the end taken up on the edge of the atmosphere and woven into the nests of birds. The trees would transfer the string through their heartbeat, below the ground and to their roots. This created a network that connected all living or once lived things. The large ones continued to cook as the hair twirled past them, pushed onwards by the heat of their fires. This it did for an eternity, soaking in deep knowledge and eventually making itself into an old man. Baralga named her son Jackie Bird.
Beautiful.
Yes. Thank you, Nadi. So, Karen, please.
Okay. This is a bit where Bridget, the main character, she's been walking a long time and for years, and she meets a lot of people and leaves them all the time. So I'll start here. About the time Bridget realised Isabel had no more to tell her about Daniel, her feet began to itch. At first it was just a little itch, not more than a tingle. Nothing a good scratch couldn't resolve. Too soon, scratching only made her feet feel hot. This irritation was waking her up at night with a frantic urge to scratch her soles. Bethel gave her some calamine lotion to dab on them, and it gave her some relief. A week later, Isabel was puzzled by a restlessness she sensed in Bridget. Sitting by the fire while the girls played chasey with their cousins, Bridget took off her shoes and rubbed the soles of her feet. Isabel saw the redness and made a clicking sound. She got up and went into her humpy and came straight out again. She handed Bridget a small jar. Bridget opened the lid and sniffed the greenish balm. "For your feet," said Isabel, "rub it in." She did as she was told and felt immediate relief. Isabel said, "It might take away the redness from all your scratching, but it won't stop your feet from itching." Bridget sighed, "Would anything?" "There's no cure to be found around here. Looks like you've got wandering feet. Those feet want to get walking again." "I have been thinking it's time to leave. I just don't know where I should go." "That's never stopped you before." Bridget nodded, remembering that little bird from years ago that she had followed without questioning, without fear, and without purpose. In contrast, all those years she'd walked with her daughters was to find Danny. Then she had a purpose, a why, but not a where. And now? Isabel had asked around. No one had seen or heard from Danny for many years, not since he'd boarded a train headed north. All Isabel knew was that her nephew Daniel, having found the inland sea that called to him, had gone back to the woman he loved. Isabel now knew that Bridget hadn't been there waiting, Bridget and Danny had most probably crossed over the same country, sat by a campfire and gazed up at the same stars, just not together. "He's out there somewhere," remarked Isabel, as if reading her mind. "I have a growing feeling that I'll never see him again." "Maybe so. Doesn't mean he's not still out there."
Wonderful, thank you. So there are no questions in the Q&A box from our audience as yet.
Someone did ask where Karen was. I just said to them that she's out bush, Marcia.
Yeah, she's out bush. Mm-hmm. And she's coming to us via audio, but I can see a photo of her, and I hope you can too, with her lovely curly hair. So I'm going to do what those dreadful workshop facilitators do and just throw around a whole bunch of terms in the absence of questions from our audience. And let's see what you have to say, and I'll come to each of you. Family saga, family history, elders, generations, secrets, the strength of women, Indigenous women, that is, struggle, Aboriginal rights, culture and spirituality, how the spirit world invades our mundane lives, the king plate, the crocodile, the woolly wagtail, and as Karen reminded us, the strand of hair, the writer's struggle, poverty, many years of writing before recognition. So I thought we might want to talk about how long you each have been writing, or in Nadi's case, singing and composing. So you're hardly the new wave. And amongst you, you've won a swag of awards and been shortlisted and longlisted for an even bigger swag of awards. So there's also, I'm going to throw in another key word, term, magical realism. So in your case, Melissa, and I will say there's an element of magical realism in each of these novels, but in your case, Melissa, I'd like to call it satiric realism with a touch of magical realism.
Right. Yeah, when I hear magical realism, I hear a chorus of blackfellow writers, Marcia, and you, Nadi, and Karen would possibly have heard it too, the idea that we call it Indigenous realism rather than magical realism. And I think that maybe comes kind of out of a bit of a misunderstanding and a thought that magical realism came from the Western canon, when, of course, you've got people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who was one of the first, as far as I'm aware, to introduce magical realism, and that's coming out of a South American and very strongly Indigenous framework. But the clearest memory I have to do with magical realism is seeing Kerry Hume, a great hero of mine, the author of The Bone People, at the very first Writers' Festival I ever attended in 1997. It was in Sydney, and I was living in Tonga, and I had to fly from Nuku'alofa to Sydney and take part in this festival of Indigenous writing from all around the world. And Kerry Hume was there, and I found out from the hotel somehow which room she was in, and I went and knocked on a door and annoyed her, and ended up having a drink with her in her room and having a yarn for an hour. And it was just fabulous. And what she said to me was, well, they talk about magical realism, but it's completely normal, you know, for us to be talking and then to break into song and then to start discussing the spirits. And it's just the way we live our Māori lives. And, of course, that, you know, goes for us. It goes for the South Americans. It goes for many, many people. It probably goes for the, you know, the first peoples of Europe, the Celts and whoever came before the Celts. So it's not unique to us, and it's not particularly magical, I think.
And I wanted to ask you a question about that. So I guess, you know, the people who write these blurbs and use terms like magical realism picked up on what you write about the way that perhaps some of your characters felt about the impact of finding the king plate and the knowledge of the new knowledge of some ancestry. And you weave that into the story in the most delightful way. Some people might think that's magical realism, but I think you've explained your approach very well. Tell us about, you know, the impact of the king plate and, you know, genealogical knowledge.
Yeah, well, the king plate, I used the motif or the symbol of a king plate in the story because, culturally speaking, of course, it's not acceptable to use actual sacred objects as a motif in a modern novel, and you know, I don't have permission to do that, and I would never get permission to do that or seek it. And so by taking a European artefact that is the King Plate, and lots of people would regard that as a, you know, a fake artefact at best and a symbol of slavery at worst. And Kerry looks at the King Plate and wonders, you know, how to regard it. Should she regard it as a blessing or as a curse? You know, it's a thing with chains on it that has come from the invader, but her great-grandmother has sung a song into it, and the great-grandfather has put his power into it, and now it's a charm that, you know, is around the necks of her people. So it's about the power of spirituality to transform an object regardless of its origins. And I suppose in a way that speaks to culture not sitting within extremely rigid boundaries, extremely fixed boundaries, which I think people fall into the trap of believing that things culturally speaking can only be one thing at once and not many things.
Beautiful. Brilliant answer. So, Nadi, there's a question in the Q&A for you. I'll read it out, but I really do want you to address this element of culture that Melissa was speaking about in your work, but I'll read this question from Eve on Wurundjeri Country. My question relates to the ending of your work. You could end it however you wanted. In the end, on my reading, justice was not served and the people of the town appear to learn nothing. Thank you.
Ooh. I think what I wanted to do in the work, well, you know, when I started writing this story, I thought, if this book ends up on the shelf at Walgett Community College in the library, done, happy, tick, success. If there's one at Lightning Ridge High School, double tick, even happier. This image of that book doesn't even need to be opened, mind you. Something about it going back to where those words came from, going back to the knowledges, and it is a work of fiction, but it's all... I wanted it to be reflective of us. That book sitting there was my measure of success. I guess some type of answer to that question is, if that book gets opened by a kid at the school or parent or whoever, teacher, whatever, I want them to have a different ending to perhaps what you did, Eve, because it was really important for me to say, listen, some things don't make sense to us as black fellas in our own culture, but we're down with that because it just means that meaning will be made later, perhaps, or meaning stayed with somebody else to hold on to that for you. And letting that go, the need for understanding and the need for closing a circle, I think is something, you know, that I recognise in my family, my community, and I'm really proud of to be an inheritor of, that if something doesn't make sense to me, it doesn't mean it doesn't make sense, it just means I'm not there yet. And so I place myself in relation to the story or the words, just as somebody else, you know, who doesn't know, who might be Aboriginal but not Yuwalari would do, and they'd have a different outcome. And see, so then this is a muddled up way of saying, as any different can be read in that book, is actually the point of it, because some people have access to things and some people don't. And what I didn't want to do, translating or walking from music into literature, is to play a literary game that meant that things, I didn't want to, you know, I'd done 22 years of singing, investing in the moment, exchanging with an audience and making sure that they felt what it was I was offering. This was a way for me to break all those kind of creative bonds and write a story that might have meant something to someone, meant something to another one. Some mob are confused, some mob think they've got it, some mob. And so then all of a sudden the knowledge of how that ends is dispersed, and I'm not the one that holds that. And maybe people will continue to find and navigate and think about how those things how it could end. And maybe it ends one way when you read it and 10 years later it ends a different way. That is the power of story that I understand works the people that I'm connected with anyway.
Thank you, Nadi. That's a great way to explain life itself, really. But anyway, if you would please address this question of, you know, the, let's call it the impact of the ancestral past that you address in your novel and the magic of that. Let's not get, you know, romantic about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people who study literature might call it magical realism, but there is a certain magic to it. I think you've brought that, you know, into your writing. We can't explain it, as you say.
Mm. And it's a funny word, eh, magic, because, I mean, I always think about this thing. If it's magical or spiritual, the weight of that thing doesn't impose upon the person who is partaking of it. But in the way I understand Blackfella Way, that magic is power to affect people directly. So I think, you know, what I make sure I don't do is bring in all these kind of what a, people might think are cultural or spiritual elements. And for that to be, you know, this lyrical, beautiful whateverness that has no bearing on how you move forward or how you live your life or how you turn a page. Those things, that the magic is actually the law. The more out there it is, the more important it is for you to make that part of your lived life and to interact with. It's not this oscillating thing that is outside of, you know, your experience. It's actually, that's like the reference section in the library and that's the constitution and all those things. Those things are the information you need to live your life in a respectful and helpful way to others. That's how I get about it anyway. So magic, I think, in this sort of, in a Western context, is a place you just let things happen and, oh, that was interesting or unusual or, but, you know, for definitely for me and people I'm connected to, that state of, that magical state is actually when you sit down and you open ears and you quiet and you listen because you're being given information there that you need to take forward and act on. So, you know, that's sort of how I come at it.
I would love to hear from Karen. Let's hear from Karen on this question because it comes up in your work, Where the Fruit Falls, birds, all sorts of things.
Yep.
And you are becoming an expert on this literary device that some people see, magical.
Yeah. I've just spent the last 2 years studying and researching as part of my master's as what is magic realism within Aboriginal authored text. And after 2 years, I got a little bit stuck because it really, really rarely exists, in my opinion. Like there's a lot of Aboriginal realism that's lyrical and satirical and playful and has some of the markers of magic realism, but the only book that I can really strongly, confidently say uses magic realism as a narrative technique is Carpentaria by Alexis Wright, and to a lesser degree, Benang by Kim Scott with the metaphor of floating. I got a little bit stuck, so I've put the masters on hold.
Well, I think we've learned a lot tonight from Nadi and Melissa on this question, and perhaps we need to have our own workshop, and you're just the right person to organise it, Karen.
And that's what I've put in my thesis, yeah. Definitely have to have this conversation and talk back to critiques, the people critiquing and all that, because they're misreading the work. I mean, constantly anything they don't understand and they're seeing through the white lens, to make them feel more comfortable, they whack the title of magic realism on rather than engaging with the work with what it is. It could be Aboriginal realism, it could be Indigenous futurism, but they're not engaging.
Yes, it does feel like a pretty easy label to slap on widely disparate novels. But this is why I've addressed this question to you. I threw the term in to be provocative. I actually love the realism of your works. But anyway, let me just turn to the audience. Michael Duke says, thank you all from Ngarruk Wilam area, Bunurong country. Question for Nadi about Garia, what Katie Langlo Parker called courier. Courier? The being seems to be pinned at the end, meeting his end through the efforts of Jackie Bird. In the KLP version, or Katie Langlo Parker version, Byamee kills the two couriers but rescues his wives. What do you think happens to Millie?
Those two works. Well, Katie Langlo Parker, that stuff is a little bit my business, but mostly not. Little bit our business, mostly not. And probably the best way to kind of have some resolution to people wanting to land in a place at the end of the book is to say, my mob will recognise the last page as the beginning of a really big story. And it's interesting that Katie Langlo Parker's work is coming up because, you know, that's one take on our I mean, she called that myths and legends, you know. We call it lore. So there's a big disparity, some word, about cultural material. And she is almost connected and wound into our dreaming, but our mob own the dreaming. Our mob own the story. And I kind of believe, you know, I think it's beautiful when I hear Iwalarai people insert, it's like diving in to these old things and coming out and writing songs, making dances, or writing poetry, like drinking at the edge of the river of that culture. And I think, you know, I think our old people would be proud of that interaction with these old things, that we're drinking from it and then sustaining ourselves. So what I'm trying to say is the weight of that old amateur ethnographer is not important to where the book lands. She's been, you know, she's been swirled up into Iwalarai dreaming. And if you're reading Langlo Parker as the authoritative voice on Iwalarai people, I'd ask you to go and listen to Iwalarai writers and dancers and leaders and singers and actors and whatever, and recalibrate and take that as the reference material, because that's how we are. That's how we're keeping that dreaming going, if I can say it like that. Oh, you know, I don't want her to have all the weight of things. And the last page, like I said, the last page is the beginning of one of our most important creation stories. And Iwalarai people will know that. And the last page is for them. There's also an open invitation to allow that, maybe not to understand, but to allow. It's probably the best way I can say it, yeah.
And Karen, given Nadi's, I think, you know, brilliant distinction or contradistinction that she draws between these white authors who, you know, drop these stereotypes or tropes into Australian culture about our cultures, and we so rarely get it. Well, we do get an opportunity, but it is such a hard-earned opportunity to speak back to those stereotypes about our culture. You address this. I think, you know, people talk about healing, and I'm fascinated in these three novels, the strength of women, their, you know, the family saga, and their great strength and healing power. Do you want to address that in relation to your novel, Karen?
Okay. I'm not sure about other writers, but often it's not until the work's done that I sort of realise what the themes were or what's come out. So I didn't necessarily going in there thinking about healing, even though it's there. I did go in wanting to explore history. Like the whole idea for this book came from when I was sitting and painting and listening to Nina Simone sing Strange Fruit. And I started thinking about how a lot of Australians know more about that history in that song and not the history here on this continent, and specifically colonisation and everything that's happened then. So I went in purposely wanting to write about history and where we are now to some extent. So there's a lot of history in there. And I think that through history is a healing, but also, like you said, all of our books have strong women, and I think there's healing in that sisterhood as well.
Thank you. There are some more comments in the Q&A, and I'll drop something on you, and I'll give you time to think about it while I read out these comments. You know, country is a big, big concept, and it's tied up with our ancestral past and all of these things that we've been talking about. So we'll come to that. From Julia, a comment, not a question. Let us honour our writers, their achievement and their discretion to end stories as they wish to. Kudos. Lynn Pye from Wadawurrung Country. So lovely to listen to you all. Melissa, I just love Too Much Lip, and especially the actual words you used. My lexicon of colourful swear words and phrases increased enormously, and I feel richer for it. Hi, Melissa. I love Too Much Lip. Did you find your readers responded well to a feisty character? Did people find it confronting to have a gritty protagonist? Thank you. Michael Duke. Thank you, Nardi. I learn daily, and I shall seek to continue to do so, dreaming law, whatever. Maddie Moore. Melissa, Too Much Lip presents characters with great richness, depth and complexity, who work as a gateway for the reader to explore society, culture, history, etc. What led you to use your characters in this way? Thank you, Maddie from Bunurong Land. Many of you will not know, perhaps, that Melissa was one of the founders of Sisters Inside. So I just want to give the heads up on that and honour Melissa's great work. So, Melissa, over to you.
Yeah, thanks for the kind comments, everyone. The swear words. One of the Logan City aunties came up to me a year or two ago, and she said, you're that writer. I said, yes, auntie, I am that writer. She said, there's a lot of swearing in your books. I said, yes, aunt, there is a lot of swearing in my books. She said, I love it. And I had a big laugh of relief with her. Why did I write the characters the way I did? I think in a lot of way I was processing stuff. You know, your first novel, I wrote my first novel in 1997, and your first novel famously is the young writer or the emerging writer processing their life through the mechanism of a novel. And when I wrote my first novel, I intended to stick it in a bottom drawer and leave it and then go on and write a better novel and try and get that published. But somewhere along the way, I forgot about that good idea and I published the first one instead. I can see Nardi laughing here. And as you go on throughout your career, you process your own stuff less and less, and you're more mature as a writer. You're more developed and able to see the world in a different way, and not just through the lens of your own personal history or your own personal neuroses. But I have a brother who's a Vietnam veteran and has severe PTSD, and who went to prison for using and dealing ice in the early 2000s. And it was seeing him after he'd been to jail and come out and care for our aged, frail mother, and the kind of tension in him between having that history of being a veteran and having an extremely hard life in lots of ways and caring for our mother. And it made me think about masculinity a lot, I think. And so the character of Ken came partly from that and partly from some other blokes I've been around and know. Including a mafia guy in Melbourne, actually, come to think of it. And the reasons I write the characters that I write is I originally started with 5 siblings, but I decided 5 was too many, so I came to 4 siblings, and they all started in this small country town. They'd all grown up with violence and poverty and racism and exclusion and loss, the loss of the sister, Donna. And it was about the different directions that people can take in their lives when they come from the same starting point or a similar starting point. And so the four siblings have their different lives and they all have their own challenges, they have their own strengths, and together it's about how they protect country and how they come together as a family despite everything they've been through. I hope that answers your question.
Brilliant. I'm just going to share a PowerPoint. Now, I promised I wouldn't, and you're all thinking, oh, no, death by PowerPoint. The thing is, I just really want to convey this message during the course of this wonderful session. None of these writers are new on the scene. I mean, I've been, you know, familiar with their work, be it writing or other creative works, for a very long time. Melissa has been shortlisted, longlisted, won awards. She's written in many different genres. So, you know, she's by no means the new wave. She's one of our senior writers, Steam Pigs, Killing Darcy, Hard Yards, Two Flash, so many essays, very interesting work, Sinking Below Sight, Down and Out in Brisbane and Logan, that won the 2013 Walkley Award for Long Film Journalism. You should become familiar with her work. She's one of Australia's great writers, without a doubt. And so this novel, Too Much Lip, is by no means her first novel. Nadi was in the Indigenous folk duo Stiff Gins, and she's been performing in Australia and internationally for 20 years. She's an educator, musician, composer, and I listened today to Treading Water. It's on SoundCloud, and it's part of a larger artistic work called Songs from Home. So please listen to that. So you get a sense of how she captures not just our cerebral sense but also all the other senses. And Karen is a freelance writer. Now, Karen, I hope you don't mind me mentioning that you once owned a bookshop, which I used to follow. You too have been writing for a very long time. You're from the Mardu people, famously the people whose terrible history under A.O. Neville, the protector, and before that, the colonial invaders, amounted to what was called a genocide in the Bringing Them Home report. And your works include Where the Fruit Falls, winner of the 2020 Dorothy Hewitt Award, Heroes, Rebels and Innovators, Inspiring Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander People from History, When Rosa Came Home, which is no longer available, unfortunately, and now you're doing your master's thesis, and I look forward to that being published as well. So let's go to this huge concept of country, which each of you deal with in your own way. Melissa?
Yeah, country, I don't want to suggest that I'm any kind of cultural expert because I'm not. I have a lot to learn. At the same time, I do have some understanding. So I think I'll preface what I'm saying by saying that I believe that people think about country, that people talk about being on country these days as if some places in Australia are country and some places aren't, which is just silly, you know, in my understanding anyway. Everywhere is country. Everywhere has traditional owners. Everywhere has spirit and law. Everywhere has power and power places. So we're always on country wherever we are. It's just a matter of whether it's our country or not as First Nations people. But country is so much more than the earth under our feet, of course. You know, country is a state of being, as I understand it. And Nadi, you would know a lot more about this than I would, sis. And Karen, you may as well. I'm just piecing it together from an assimilated history, really. But my understanding is that country is not just earth, it's waters, it's stars, it's winds, it's animals, it's trees, it's sound, it's emotion. It's made up of the entire experience of being sentient, I suppose. And that just, it really speaks to what Nadi was saying earlier about this minang and the capacity to listen and the capacity to stop talking, to stop chattering, and to shut up and listen to country and to the other people who are themselves part of country. And, we live lives where it's difficult to shut up and listen, but all we can do is try. And in my work, I try and convey numinous experiences, I suppose, where my characters sometimes relate to country in that way that is bigger than themselves, bigger than anything, because it's a majestic whole. And of course, that's at the heart of our traditions. I'll leave it at that.
I love that you use that word, numinous.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mm. Nadi?
I think while you're talking, Melissa, and definitely for me, you know, a way to commune or listen from the place that I'm not physically in is to write and sing, so to be there. And just when you were talking, I thought, you know, I was thinking I'll come a long way, you know, because singing I was doing for a very long time, and, you know, my writing was doing exactly what you were describing in those early days. You know, you tell everyone how you see the world, and you sort of, you make sense of it through just talking about you. And then when you get older, you realise, of course, there's more to life than what you see. And making that space for things like country, but also listening to the country in others. Mm. Just when you were talking, I was thinking, this is on my list of things to do now. The pattern of your words made me realise I need to focus more, not just on me connecting when I'm away, and not just on living the values of what I understand my country is, which is some based around somewhere being generous and kind and strong, but also listening, using your ears to listen to country speak in others, you know, because it is that beautiful, all-encompassing thing. Mm. It's in everything and everyone, and a way to practice what I understand is important Yuluroi way of respect, but also, you know, sort of privileging others first, is finding, listening, connecting to their country in them, or their country in their work, or their country in their listening. This is, and then, you know, you think, well, that's a good way to live. But placing country, whatever it is at that moment in time, placing yourself actually at the foot of that means, you know, you're not going to get too big for your boots, and you're always going to make sure that other people have the space that they need. You're sort of, to me, that's the way that you are connected. You stay connected to that, there's some word which I don't know, that important part of everyone. I sort of see, anyway, I see it like a little crystal everyone carries about that sort of that pulsating spirit of who they are and where they're from. And if we can make space for that in the way we live our lives, that's probably a good way to be. But I also have a pet peeve about when they say, you know, I'm on country, because it means places like Sydney, people assume the more built up it is not traditional sacred land. And I tell you what, it absolutely is. And they're the places that we need to make sure that we acknowledge, because there has been this such violent change. You know, I always think about that in Sydney. You should walk down the quay and look at those big buildings and know that it's standing on sacred. It's what's that word? Emerging from sacredness. And that's the truth, bottom line. So, I always get wild about that too. You know, on country, like, we have to go out bush to be connected, you know. Sorry. Gadigal people can walk around, and I'm sure Brisbane mob and, you know, wherever, walk around their homelands and feel that same thing as someone out, you know, when I go out to Narran Lakes, and those things are not different. They are exactly the same there.
Yeah, it reminds me, I had a honours student at Lismore Uni recently. She's interested in writing and thinking about the intersection of, you know, Indigenous knowledges and white theorising about country and stuff like that. And it took a little while to get her to see that, you know, we could be sitting in the quad at Lismore Uni with concrete pavers underneath us and the brick buildings around us and saying, yeah, well, you don't actually have to go to the rainforest to think about these things. You can think about them right here and now in this place, in this European-looking place, because it is about values and connection, and values and connection are relevant everywhere, not just when you are out looking at a goanna in a fig tree.
And so Karen, being Māori, and, you know, of course, that's the country which I meant to say before, where, you know, the story by Doris Pilkington of the rabbit-proof fence comes from, and then made into a vast deserts. And you bring the desert to life in your novel. And I think each country has its own special quality. You know, say when I land in Mianjin in an aeroplane, I can smell those mangroves, and it's so familiar to me from my teenage years when I went to high school in that part of the world. And, you know, there's a shape of the ranges that is just so familiar. Karen, tell me about how you feel about country.
Okay, so it's complicated. I mean, I was born here on Gunnedah, so down in South Australia, and lived here all my life. I have travelled a fair bit, but I've not spent time on country, my own country, my grandmother's country, but which means that I've, you know, had to form my own relationship with the country that I'm here around me, but in a respectful way. But yes, whenever, and I live by the sea, but whenever I see that red dirt, yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain. You just, it's singing, like it's feeling alive. But I can feel that way with a lot of places I go to. I'm not good in living in concrete worlds, like I've never have been. I live on the fringe, and I try to get outside at least once a day to go to the beach, the scrub, the forest, whatever. So being on country has always been important to me. Even as a child, I grew up on a farm, and yeah, I was always outside. But yeah, it's really complicated. Like, I think for me with writing, I try to be really respectful and careful in that I'm not setting it up so someone will pick up my work and go, oh, this is all cultural, what she's saying about country, because I am very aware that, you know, my learning really is really just like a child still, and it may never be more than a child's learning, and that is really beyond my means, because, you know, the stolen generations caused all those breakages, but that doesn't mean that I can't take the time to create relationships with other people, and more specifically with country and non-human beings. Does that sort of answer the question?
Oh, I'm not absolutely very good with them. But I want to disagree with you about something. I think your understanding is not childlike at all or childish. I think the way that you write about that strand of hair is very, very powerful. And, you know, I grew up, well, no, actually it was later in my, when I was a young adult, I was told, you know, when I was brushing my hair, not to leave my hair about. I think you get it exactly right, Karen, and I love your writing. And we're being told that we're coming up to the end of the hour, and we'll be cut off very suddenly. I can see you wanting to say something, Melissa, and I don't think there's any need to answer the Q&A questions that have come up at the last minute. Melissa.
I actually was going to refer to one of those questions, Marcia, about how are non-Indigenous people to relate to this idea of country. And I'll just hark back to what you said about treaty, that, you know, this country is without honour until treaty is established with First Nations, between the Australian state and First Nations. And when we have treaty, then we can go forward. I think on a spiritual level, that's a whole different conversation that would take at least 6 hours to begin having. But if you speak to the elders and custodians of the area where you live, I think your name was Jan, you will find a way to be on country in an honourable and satisfying and mutually beneficial way. I'll just end there. So Boogal Bear Jimbalung, thank you, friends.
Thank you, Melissa. Did you want to say anything, Nadi?
I was just saying to myself, beautiful words.
Yeah, beautiful words, yes. Well, thank you so much to the audience for joining us this evening. Thank you very much, Melissa, Nadi, and Karen. It's been an absolute delight for me to have this opportunity to talk to you. I'm a huge fangirl of your work, and it's so wonderful to have an evening with three brilliant women writers who tell the family saga and, you know, the cultural underpinnings in such a beautiful way, such a powerful way. It's been an absolute honour for me, and I look forward to your future works, but I have some catching up to do with your past works as well. And Nadi, I'll be looking out for your musical legacy and listening to more of it. I absolutely love Treading Water. Beautiful. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.